Welcome back to this week's episode of the Dude Therapist. We were off for a week, but we have an episode for you. We have Mina B, who is a licensed social worker, mental health educator, and author of Owning Our Struggles. She is also the founder of a mental health consulting practice where she collaborates with organizations to help them develop psychological safety. Additionally, Mina is the host of the Very Well Mind podcast, runs an advice column for Cosmopolitan magazine called Free Therapy, and also is a member of the Mental Health Advisory Committee for Wondermind, a mental fitness company co-founded by Selena Gomez. An expert in her field, Mina has been featured in various media outlets, including Red Table Talk, Peace of Mind with Taraji, Oprah Daily, Katie Couric Media, and more. Mina currently resides in New York City, and I am so honored to have her on this episode to talk about how we deal with struggles in life and not just move past them, not just move through them, but build stronger, better selves through struggles, from struggles, and with struggles that happen to many of us. So thank you so much for tuning in. Here's a word from our sponsors. This week's episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. In a world where we are bombarded with things all around us, we sometimes forget to do things with our life, our extra time, the small moments, and it's sometimes very hard to feel like we're being productive. And I'll tell you, therapy can help find production in life, help guide, help have someone listen, and help have someone truly hear you with the needs that you're looking for to get out of the hectic lifestyle that we all have. I know for myself that I've used therapy for years to help me keep balanced, calm, and a set of tools that help me individually. Because when it comes down to it, we all need that extra help. We all need someone in our corner. And if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try, because it doesn't hurt to just try once. And if you love it, you stick with it. And if you don't, at least you tried to pick yourself, to find what you need with convenient, flexible therapy model, BetterHelp. So learn to make that time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/DudeTherapist today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/DudeTherapist. Don't wait to find the help that you need. Hello and welcome to this week's episode of the Dude Therapist. We have Mina B on, who just wrote a book, Own Our Struggles. And I think, I don't know about you, maybe you did this on purpose. The world that we're in today is struggling. Post-pandemic, all the things. I think it's a perfect timing for a book like this. And before I get into your work, how awesome you are, your content and the things that you put out there, can you introduce yourself a little bit to the listeners before we get into it?
Sure. Well, hi, everyone. As Ali shared, my name is Mina B, and I am a licensed social worker, mental health educator, and author of the book Owning Our Struggles. I have a background in clinical therapy. I practiced working in private practice as well as community mental health, working with adult clients who struggle with depression, anxiety, and trauma. I also have experience working in early Head Start here in New York City, working with children ages 0 to 5 on their social and emotional development and providing assistance to their families and their staff. And then 2020, I will say more so 2021, I transitioned out of seeing clients to do corporate wellness, where now I work with organizations to help them develop psychological safety. And on August 22nd, I released my first book, which is, as I shared earlier, Owning Our Struggles. And the core concept of the book is how to heal from trauma and other mental health related issues through community care.
So something I always ask the professionals that come on here is, what pushed you into the world of mental health? We all have a story. We all have a reason. But what kind of pushed you into the door of grad school and this direction of life?
Mm-hmm. So my own personal journey with mental health, as cliche as it sounds, that's traditionally how most of us get here. I struggled with anxiety and depression as a child. However, I went undiagnosed for a very long time because it wasn't something that my family understood. And it wasn't until I was in high school that I remember going to see a guidance counselor. And the reason why I went to see a guidance counselor is because I had shared with one of my close friends that I was suicidal and I had started cutting as a form of coping. And that opened the doorway to my friend knowing that they cared about me and wanted me to get as much support as possible. And nobody knew what that even looked like, especially when you're a teenager, especially growing up in the 90s like I did. Growing up in that era, I think a lot of people now, you easily go on Instagram, you're like, okay, I know like some different things on how to help you, but I did not have that when I was growing up in society. But I am grateful that I did have my guidance counselor in school who was able to really, one, help me understand what mental health was, help name the things that I was going through. So first time hearing the word depressed, and you're dealing, it sounds like you're dealing with depression. And after that, I think I just remember being really intrigued by human behavior, being really intrigued by understanding the things that impacted me, but also being curious about, well, what about other people who are going through this, especially people who look like me, whose families don't know anything about mental health, especially being a Black woman, being a first generation Black Hispanic woman, where in my parents' country, people assumed mental health was drug abuse, and that's it. Nobody knows what anxiety is back home in Panama, you know? So that is what led me to want to pursue some field in psychology, whether it be social work, just anything related to mental health. And for undergrad, I did study business because at that time, I still wasn't sure like what I wanted to commit myself to. But in business school, I had a sociologist professor who was a social worker. And I loved her so much that she is actually the person who inspired me to pursue my master's in social work.
It only takes that one person, right?
That one person.
And look how people you're changing because of that one person. That's so such a interesting story. And you know, I grew up in the 90s also. And interesting enough, I have ADHD and I was pushed into therapy and that process. And because of that, I'm a therapist, right? Because I saw the power of that. You know, there's something about struggling that I think we think is so isolated that only we are struggling.
Yeah.
You know, in the research and the work that you've done on your book and the knowledge that you have of seeing struggle, why is it so easy to jump into that realm of thinking? Like, I'm struggling. It's only me. No one will understand. I'm alone.
Yeah, I think there are multiple factors. I think the first thing that comes up is this feeling of shame. I think often people associate struggling with failure or struggling with not being good enough. And I think there are a lot of outside influences that create that type of mental conditioning. I think depending on your family system, if you've been told that you have to be strong, if nobody is talking about hardships, if people are talking about it in a way that makes you sound like a flawed, imperfect human being who's unworthy, then you're going to feel this sense of shame if you become the thing that is negatively talked about. I think it also happens in society too, where, you know, we glamorize a lot of things in our culture, you know, and so it's not normalized, especially when I was growing up, or like how you shared growing up, right? Back then, nobody was talking about mental health on the television or on, well, what we had was what, AOL and MySpace. And so there was no public, there were no public platforms. And I also just think about the intergenerational aspect where, you know, I know my parents, when I listen to their stories, it's the same thing of you have to be strong. There is no such thing as feeling bad and feeling down. And you got to push through. And so I think that it's often associated with this feeling of shame, where I feel like I'm a terrible person. I feel like I'm a failure. I feel like I'm not good enough. If I realize that I am struggling with some particular thing, and I definitely wrote this book so that people could see that there is no shame in struggling, you know, and that's why in my book, I break down the different types of struggles people face so that we can, one, start to normalize it and also get to the root of what those struggles are, and also decide to break some cycles in our own family unit, but also in society, and say, you know what, I don't have to feel ashamed for feeling the things that I feel. If I acknowledge it, then that allows me to do the work to heal from it.
And, you know, it's just so interesting how we have this vision of perfection for some reason when it comes to being a human. When so often we talked about we're flawed, we're not perfect, you know, we make mistakes, you know, people do this. And we externalize that idea so often to other people, like, oh, everyone makes mistakes. But we don't put that on ourselves, that, like, we can struggle. It's like, you know, I'm a father of two kids, and how parenting is not easy, and how parents think they need to look perfect, and that, you know, all these kind of preconceived notions. And do you think past generations had that preconceived notion as well, or they were just willing to just put their head down and put the hard work in and not care about other people?
That's a really good question. I do think it's both. And the reason why I say that is, one, I think those struggles were always present. And I think, you know, our past generations had this false idea of what was healthy, because there were certain systems in place that normalized certain things. I mean, when we think of past generations, there was a period where women were legally not allowed to work. Like, it was against the law to do that. And can we say that's a healthy thing, to deny a woman a right to want a job and pursue her passion simply because of her gender? No, that is not okay. But I do think that because we are living in a climate now where we have social media, and I do think that there's a lot of research to show that social media does have more negative impacts than positive ones, I do think that it can create this culture of stripping people away from their own form of self-efficacy and resiliency, because they feel very hopeless and powerless, and we're utilizing social media as an outlet versus recognizing self-responsibility and being forced to find tools to change and being forced to find tools to make do with what they have. You know, I'll hear a lot of people complain and say, like, you know, it's not fair that when the holidays approach that people are posting themselves, you know, sharing lavish gifts with people, like, that's not appropriate. And it's like, well, why isn't it appropriate? You know, these are real life arguments that I'll hear people say, right? Where I think that what we've done is we've said, well, I'm lacking, or I'm not happy with where I am. And now there's an opportunity for me to project or attack versus, well, let me look inward and engage in radical acceptance for where I am in life. And let me look inward and ask myself, well, where at on a scale of 1 to 10, where am I when it comes to my own self-efficacy, which is my motivation to change my particular circumstances? I think a lot of us are blinded by the things that we see that are shiny online. And back then, it's like you didn't have the opportunity to do that. So when, you know, I'm not saying that this is across the board, but I do think as we see a lot of our former generations did a lot of work to make shifts around the culture that they lived in at the time. So I think as society continues to evolve, we'll see more ways of people building resiliency.
Amazing. And, you know, you talk about in the book, the, you know, some of the basic struggles of human beings, other than finances, you know, and maybe political issues. What are some of the most common struggles that we wouldn't expect? And what are some of the most common struggles in general?
So in my book, I outlined what I perceive to be the most common struggles. And so It was really important for me to take the reader on a journey. So chapter one first explores childhood trauma, because at the end of the day, we all have a childhood. Once you turn 18, just because by law you're an adult, doesn't mean your past diminishes or disappears. You know, and your childhood can definitely impact you, especially if there was trauma in your childhood, because studies show that even 20 to 30 years later, you can still be dealing with the mental effects and emotional effects of trauma that happened in childhood. So chapter one is all about exploring childhood trauma, the big traumas, even the little traumas that we might realize is causes dysregulation to our nervous system. Then as you continue to read the book, chapter two takes us into adulthood and recognizing the signs of trauma in adulthood that is still connected to the early signs of trauma in our childhood. And then the book continues to go on a journey where it helps readers understand the different domains of adult life. So mm-hmm. it carries on to talk about the intersections of our identity, because that's important. So talking about race, and in that, in my particular book, I really focus on the BIPOC experience when I am talking about race and the intersections of our identity. Then it carries on to talk about our parent-child relationships and the difficult relationships we may have with our family mm-hmm. and tools on how to heal those relationships. Or what do I do if I want to terminate the parent-child relationship? Mm-hmm. Then it goes on to talk about romantic relationships, because romance as well as platonic relationships are vital to our well-being. And it also lastly talks about our relationship to work, understanding toxic productivity, understanding the different ways we show up in society. So I think those are the common themes that I see happening. But I think for a lot of people, they don't realize that those are very common themes that we struggle with, because as I shared, it is very normalized where if you come from a dysfunctional home, well, this is just how things are, instead of saying, this is inappropriate. Mm. This is not okay. I want to do things differently. Or even talking about the chapter in work, where I think a lot of people in our current climate are noticing, like, you know, we have rights and there are things that we want to see our workplace do mm-hmm. to support our mental health and well-being, where maybe 20 years ago, you know, if there was a tragedy in the world, you could ignore it. Where now it's like, we don't want performative allyship. We are bringing our full selves to work and we want to know that we're supported yeah. in the workplace, or we want adequate livable wages. We want adequate PTO. We want benefits mm-hmm. and we're going to fight for these things, you know? And I think mm-hmm. that those are some common themes that I find that a lot of adults struggle with. But I do also see that we are moving the needle, you know, because it's mm-hmm. definitely different compared to when I was growing up.
Yeah. And I love that point you're making. There's something that is like a killer of progress is the concept of saying, well, it's always been this way. We're going to continue doing things that way. I was talking to a friend of mine who is in the medical world, and they were complaining about the 24-hour shifts, right? Mm-hmm. That and complaining to a supervisor, and the supervisor was like, we used to have 48-hour shifts. This is nothing. It doesn't mean the 24-hour shifts is good just because you had 48.
Exactly.
Right? You know, if research shows that a doctor or a medical professional or a nurse or a NPPA, whatever it is, has a 24-hour shift, and how many people get into accidents on their way home because they're basically driving drunk because they're that tired, right. Doesn't make it good just because you used to have 48 and you suffered. And even with, you know, I think since the pandemic, the idea of a reality of what work-life balance is, mm-hmm. Is something that is shifting, even though there's been research for years by Adam Grant on the idea of what work-life balance is in other countries, as well as mm-hmm. societal things that could change. And people are speaking up and saying something. The question I have is, okay, everyone struggles in some way or another. What makes the distinction or the difference in your mind of a struggle that is a healthy struggle versus a struggle that's hurtful or something that needs to be dealt with? Because struggle is not the end of the world.
Yeah.
But there's a difference of like, okay, so I'm doing a workout and it's hard.
Right.
What's the, or parenting is hard, right? what is the difference between like something being hard and a healthy struggle, or a something that is out of the ordinary, something that we need to change or work on now?
Well, I'll get to the most obvious answer, which is I think the unhealthy struggle is the one that causes you great harm.
Yeah.
An unhealthy struggle is one that is rooted in abuse, and one that can one, kill you, and two, cause you great harm to your spiritual, mental, or even emotional well-being. So if I continue to engage in this struggle, it will literally deteriorate my mental well-being and my mental health. This thing is not getting me closer to a goal. This thing is not conducive of a healthy lifestyle. This thing is actually shown to produce more negative side effects compared to positive ones. This thing probably has no end if I continue to deal with it and put up with it. And so I think that those are some signs when the struggle that you find you're enduring is one that can be extremely harmful. I think that there are things that, as you shared, working out can be extremely hard. But are there ways to one, adjust your workout to accommodate you and your needs and your goals? Yes. Are there things that a person can do to get through their workout so they can meet a healthy goal, right? And I think that's what we have to learn to distinguish between certain things, where what is the outcome and is my outcome rooted in reality versus my own delusion? You know, because I do think sometimes people have a fixed belief where they think this struggle is appropriate because they're like, well, I love this person. So even though they hurt me continuously, mentally, emotionally, and spiritually, love is enough despite that I am being harmed in the midst of it. So those are some ways that I would help people understand. Like, there is a difference between knowing that there's certain things in life, and that's what I outline in my book. Adversity is always going to come our way. There is no such thing as healing so much that you will never have a bad day. You know, that is not what healing is. Healing is not the more I do this work, the more only good things are going to happen to me. But the healing is what helps you use discernment and wisdom to know what is worth my energy, what is healthy enough, where what are the things that are healthy enough where if I engage in it and I put my effort and time in fixing this thing, there are going to be there's going to be a positive reward and outcome on the other end versus something that continuously diminishes me over time, impacts the longevity of my life, creates psychological withering, and weathering where I am like literally mentally deteriorating over time. And those are the things that help us to know, like, this is not a struggle worth enduring.
I love that distinction. That's super important for people to hear, because there is going to be a healthy struggle of something. And if it's deteriorating you so much that you can't function or you're not okay, it's not worth it. How do we, you talk about a lot about community, right? As being a source of that safety. What does community actually mean nowadays? What's healthy community look like, and how do we create that?
Well, your community is your circle of support. And when you talk about, when you think about your circle of support, it should range from interpersonal relationships up until even social and systemic issues that happen in our country. So when you're thinking of your circle of support in the context of a community, there are four different domains. You're thinking one of your circle of intimacy, because those are your closest connections. And generally, our family falls in our circle of intimacy. But I want people to also remember that sometimes your family can be harmful. Sometimes your family is unsafe. And so your friends can be in your circle of intimacy. So that's one domain. The second domain is your circle of friendship that makes up community. And this is important. Friendship runs on a spectrum. I think a lot of people struggle, especially with this loneliness epidemic that we're living in. I think that a lot of people are struggling with friendships and relationships because, one, the context of friendship, right? There is no language to help us really understand what a friendship looks like outside of this is my close friend or this is my best friend. Mm-hmm. We use the word friend very loosely. I'll listen to people tell me stories about their friends and they're complaining. And then I'll say like, well, is this a friend or is this just someone that you know? Because I think there's a huge distinction between the two. It seems like maybe you have expectations of this person that, and there's no reciprocity because I wonder if you all are just colleagues and that's why they don't want to have brunch with you over the weekend because to them it's a work relationship and they're not your friend, they're simply your colleague. Mm-hmm. Or you did meet this person, and maybe it isn't appropriate to ask this person that you just met a month ago if they'll be the godparent to your child, right? You know, like I want us to think about the different ways friendship manifests. And at the root of every relationship, there's trust, respect, vulnerability, and reciprocity. And I think we also have to remember that friendship is earned, especially deeply intimate friendships have to be earned. Any relationship is earned. We're all worthy human beings who are worthy of relationships. But at the end of the day, as adults, our relationships are conditional based on the fact that the conditions are you respect me. There is reciprocity. It's not a one-sided relationship because we can't thrive when there is an imbalance. The third domain when it comes to your circle of support is your circle of participation. And this is really important because this is where most of your connections come from outside of family. When you think of your really close friends, at one point they were strangers and you met them either through a friend or you met them at work. You may have met them at your mommy and me program. You may have met them at, who knows, if you go to an AA program, you may have met them somewhere in life because you engaged in a particular network that brought people together. And in there, while you were participating, you were able to build connections and those connections flourished over time, where now those people went from being in your circle of participation to being in your circle of friendship, now to being in your circle of intimacy. Or maybe they just stayed in your circle of participation and you say, you know what, next time I go to group therapy, I can't wait to meet my friend there. You know, and you have something to look forward to because, you know, once a month I go to this event and this person is going to be there. And so I'm so happy to see them. And then your last domain is your circle of exchange. And this is where we count in our paid and professional networks. And so we think about our social infrastructure. When we think of community, like I said earlier, I don't want people to think of community only in the context of individual relationships, systems. Also help build community. Do I live in a community that, you know, there's access to parks and greenery? Do I live in a walkable town? Do I live in a town that is secluded? Because studies do show that people who live in more rural towns have higher levels of loneliness, right? And so your community is also the systems involved. Do I have to drive 30 miles to go to a doctor? So are there urgent cares? Are there doctors? Are there paid and professional networks within my zip code that also plays a part in supporting me? Because again, in order for us to function, we also have to rely on a greater system, not just the people that we love. And so those are the things I want people to be thinking about when you think of community, because I'll hear a lot of people say, you know, this came up a lot during the pandemic. I moved out the city and I moved to like the most secluded town and I feel so lonely. And they're not lonely only in a context of having friends. They realize even to go to the supermarket, it's a journey. And that can add to your loneliness. If I want to find Whole Foods, if I want to find, you know, grass-fed beef, or if I want to find like farm-grown vegetables, I have to travel so far out, right? Think about that. Think about the impact that has on your mental health. That is your community. And so that shows you what you lack in your community. And so those are the domains that I want people to think about, because in order for us to function in our society, like I said, we need those human to human interactions, but we also have to rely on these systems that help us be well and whole.
I don't think I've ever heard anyone speak about community in that last way. You know, circles of friends, acquaintances, colleagues, work, environment, like all that stuff. I totally get, even maybe political communities or religious communities, yeah. Right, are huge parts of our lives. But the idea of the environment being a community of ease, like I know you said about the movie, I moved to Vegas during the right after the pandemic, because of the lifestyle that I wanted to create, which was more freedom, more slowing down in that way, a freedom of life to go outside and to be and experience 8 months out of the year with my family. Mm. That community of feeling is something that I didn't never put words that way. I love that. So what are some of the ways that we can create boundaries within our community in a healthy way that we don't forget to work on ourselves? Maybe we dive too hard into a community and not still focus. How do we create that balance? And what are some of, even though I don't like using this term, like the red flags of a community, can you talk about like Facebook groups or any like social media things about sometimes where community can be harmful, even though it has the concept of community?
Yeah. That's a good question, because it really speaks to the pseudo relationships people are building
online.
And I think that is also playing a role in a loneliness epidemic, where I think a lot of people think that they have friendships with people in this social atmosphere, mm-hmm. and they're not necessarily real.
Yep.
And I also think that it's taking, I don't know if I want to say it's taking away people's skills on how to engage in human interaction, but I'll hear people say things like, you know, I hate that one of my friends will like just watch my Instagram stories and consider that a check-in, and say like, oh, you know, they'll DM me. They won't even call me or text my phone. They'll just like literally only communicate with me through a social channel. And when I bring up like, you know, we haven't spoken in a while, they're like, I'm in your DMs and I'm liking your photos. And they consider that active communication. Mm. So I do think for some people, it is literally impacting their communicative skills, mm-hmm. as well as their social skills on knowing how to build connections. And I think that's something that we just have to be very mindful of in our society. We have to preserve these human-to-human relationships. And the only way that we can do that is to be interested and curious enough in our friends and in people that we want to know better. And we have to find ways to engage with them in intimate ways. You know, I don't think that you can really engage with somebody in an intimate way on social media, you know? And so I think that we also have to create a culture where we're making time and putting in effort to cultivate these relationships and sustain them. Because I also understand that we live in a society right now where a lot of people are busy, but relationships can't preserve themselves. And so you do have to still make room for effort and intentionality, mm-hmm. regardless of how busy our culture is becoming, because we don't want AI can't sustain relationships for us. Mm-hmm. You know, our society is currently trying to make as many quick fixes as possible to eliminate work, to eliminate jobs, to try to make your life as easier as possible. And I think we really have to remember that convenience is not always healthy. Mm. And when it comes to human interaction, the reason why we call it human to human is because that is the only way that those relationships can thrive. You know, there are no bots that can replace that. So I think we do have to think about the different ways we are preserving and creating these friendships with people. But I also think there are healthy ways that we can go about cultivating healthy relationships if what we do have is online. So for those people mm-hmm. who are like, I live in a rural community, are there virtual meetup groups or virtual book clubs or mm-hmm. even virtual cooking classes, virtual things that one takes you away from the endless scrolling that social media does, because we have to remember too, these apps are designed to keep us on the app, to keep us scrolling, to keep us, you know, engaged in things in really small sound bites, versus if I'm on an hour phone call via Zoom and we're in a book club, we're actually engaging with one another in long form as well, because no matter how many reels you watch, they're only 90 seconds long, you know? So we do have to be very intentional about that when it comes to just building those more authentic relationships and not really playing into those pseudo relationships and realizing this is why I feel alone, because some of these connections I think I have aren't actually real.
Oh, I love that you said that. That was so sassy, just what I needed to hear. Because, you know, someone just asked me about something like, oh, how do you feel that someone said this online or someone didn't say this online? And I said, I don't care.
Yeah.
I said, why not? I'm like, because it's not real.
Yeah.
I said, if social media ended tomorrow, I wouldn't know otherwise.
Yeah.
And I think that we have forgotten, you know, and something that I know for myself that I've worked on with my community, I'm very big on voice noting on WhatsApp. Because sometimes I don't always have the time to call. I do have time submitted to text, but to send a voice note and to have like a pseudo conversation back and forth where it's actually my voice has been a way that I've connected with friends over the past year or so. And I think that something that has been maybe scary a little bit is post-pandemic, we were so isolated that we kind of made our communities smaller and easier to access with all the stuff going on. And we forgot that, you know, there's more to our community than just the one or two people, but also that we need to realize that we can also be okay with a small community sometimes. Mm-hmm. And we don't need to have the big community. We don't need to have all the bells and whistles to be good and to be healthy. You know, when it comes to struggle, what are some do you feel are the top techniques that you have found have worked either for you, for people you've worked with, or even stuff that you write in your book that has helped people through? Now, of course, trauma is a totally different world. And if you really are struggling from trauma, you said everyone has a childhood and everyone's got something. Go to a therapist, talk to somebody. Please don't be shy. Don't be afraid. Help is out there and just try. That's all I say is just try. Yeah. If it doesn't work, you know, you tried. But when it comes to the techniques that you have found for the basic struggles that we do in a daily life, I know I've heard from so many people, the struggles of work-life balance, the struggles of not getting, you know, raises, like all that stress, financial stress, all the stress that we're dealing with. What are some of the techniques that you have found that really help with the stressors of today's day in life?
Mm-hmm. So, you know, I outline a lot of the techniques I'm about to share in my book. So after every chapter, there are exercises. Some chapters even include exercises or just moments of reflection within the chapter. Mm-hmm. And some of the techniques that I share in the book is one, I'm a huge advocate for mindfulness as well as breath work. And the reason why is because I always tell people, no matter where you go in life, you bring your body with you. And I think the dependency on my phone, the dependency on this tangible tool, the dependency on this object, what if I need my Calm app, but my battery is dead, right? Mm-hmm. I think that learning to master your body is such a beautiful thing because it is your body that has the first reaction to any kind of stress or trauma. Mm-hmm. And your body also has a built-in mechanism in place, which is our parasympathetic nervous system, to help us manage stress. But a lot of us don't know how to tune in to the parasympathetic nervous system. And so I think our bodies already has this built-in gift that I think that we should all be focused on trying to understand and learning to master in different ways. And the best way to do that is to, one, practice forms of mindfulness. And so how can I learn to be more present? How can I learn to be more grounded? Because I'll hear so many people share fears and anxiety, and they're either focused on the past or fixated on the future, and they're not present in the moment. So how can I engage my senses? How can I learn to be just more present with where I am and what I have? How can I also learn to incorporate deep breathing? I shared with you earlier that I currently still live in New York City. And when I am in my car and I hit traffic, I tell you, my ability to engage in breath work and take a deep breath has helped me manage stress so much, because I'm sure you know what that's like, being a former New Yorker. And there's so much that you can give your body when you just learn to take a deep breath. And I share so many different breathing techniques, from box breathing to breathing from your diaphragm, just different ways that you can learn to control your breath. I'm a big fan of journaling as well. I do think that we have to learn how to purge our mind when we are filled with thoughts and different emotions, especially thinking about CBT, how sometimes our thoughts and emotions can impact our behaviors and what we end up, the choices we end up making. So I'm a big fan of writing out my thoughts, but I also share in the book a practice called audio journaling, where sometimes we need to literally just record ourselves talking into our phone and listen to it back so that we can pick up on discrepancies in our thinking and know to pick up the difference between rational thinking and irrational thinking. Mm-hmm. It's the equivalent of, let's say a friend calls you and they're complaining and they need guidance and advice. You're able to listen to some discrepancies in their thinking and say, you know what, based off what you're sharing, I actually don't think that makes any sense. Or based off what you're sharing, like, I have a different perspective because I think that you did a really great job on this particular project that you're freaking out on. Right. And so sometimes we need to play back our own thoughts to ourselves, and audio journaling can help with that. And then lastly, I will share that I have a technique in my book called the BEST method to help people set healthier boundaries and learn, most importantly, to regulate their nervous system when they do set boundaries. Because I often find that we all know what our boundaries are. The problem is we feel too emotionally dysregulated to set them. So the BEST method helps us to understand B is what is the boundary. E is what is the emotional response to the boundary that you want to set. So you might say, I feel afraid setting this boundary. I feel anxious setting this boundary. S stands for what is the self-soothing technique that you are going to utilize to help you manage the emotional discomfort of this boundary. So you might say, I feel really afraid setting this boundary. So my self-soothing technique is going to be, I'm going to focus on deep breathing, or I'm going to write out my boundary script as a way to self-soothe and clear my mind. And then the T stands for thoughts. So what are the thoughts that I have with this boundary? What are the negative thoughts, and how can I reframe them into positive ones? So if I feel guilty about this boundary, I can now reframe it to say, guilt means I did something bad, and it's not bad to take a sick day. It's not bad to use my PTO. It's not bad to tell someone I need to call them back and I'm too tired or exhausted to be on the phone. So that is another practice that I have outlined in chapter one of my book.
Amazing. Mina, you know, I love this topic, and you know, we have to wrap up, but what would be like one takeaway that you feel people need to hear from all your work, and where can people find you and get in touch with you and get your book?
Well, the number one takeaway is remembering that we need people in order to thrive. We are biologically wired for connection. And so the number one thing I always tell people is self-care is the bridge to community care, and community care is the bridge to community healing. And so I want people to learn how to be community care focused. And that's what my book is all about. And people can find me at my website, www.minab.com. Mina is spelled MINAAB.com. On my website, you can also sign up for my newsletter, Mindful with Mina, which is a Substack, where I share different tips on how to cultivate healthy relationships. You can also find me on social media, Instagram, Facebook, and LinkedIn with the name Mina B. And my book is sold everywhere books are sold: Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Target. You can also download the Audible if you want to listen to the book. It's also available for e-readers as well.
You know, I knew you were from the 90s because you said WWW, by the way. You know, that's it. That's it. We knew. Thank you so much for being on the show. And, you know, the book, I can't wait to get my hands on it and tackle it and read it, because we all struggle and we all need as much support as we can get to help through the struggle of life. So thank you so much for all the work that you do.
Thank you for having me.
This week's episode is sponsored by Factor. Eating better is possible. Eating healthier is attainable. And it not being so difficult is right at your fingertips with Factor. In a world where we are so overwhelmed with what to do, how to do it, Factor takes out all the guesswork with no prep, no mess meals. Factor meals are ready to heat and eat, so there's no prepping, cooking, or cleanup needed. Take the guessing work out of it. If you have a tight schedule and you don't know what to do for dinner, lunch, and breakfast, it's flexible for your schedule. Get as much or as little as you need by choosing your meals every week. Plus, you can pause or reschedule your deliveries any time. Factor's the perfect solution if you're looking for fast premium options with no cooking required. Head to factormeals.com/dudetherapist50 and use code dudetherapist50 to get 50% off. That's code dudetherapist50 at factormeals.com/dudetherapist50 to get 50% off. If you're looking to make a change in your life, start today with Factor. Hey, thanks so much for listening to this week's episode of Dude Therapist Season 5. Can you believe it? I can't. What a journey. Thanks so much for tuning in. Whether it's your first episode you've listened to, or you've been a follower since the beginning, or just trying to catch up, I appreciate you. Thanks so much for really jumping in on this awesome opportunity and learning experience. You know, if you have any questions, ask them. You have thoughts, say them. I didn't finish a thought, or you have more ideas of what you would like to hear, just let me know. The door is open, so to speak. So please, walk right in. Tell me what you think. Again, thanks so much for tuning into this week's episode of The Dude Therapist, and hope that you tune in next week.